All right, if you would grab a Bible, let's be turning to James chapter 4. There is a God, and he is not me, and he is not you. And you may be saying, well, duh, but our actions and attitudes can actually say otherwise concerning how we think. People have always had a problem with putting themselves in the place of God. But there are two sections in this passage that we're going to look at today. And the first one, it has to do with judging in verses 11 and 12, and the second one has to do with planning, the way we look at the future, verses 13 through 17. Now, verses 11 and 12 probably find connection with the first part of chapter 4 concerning their quarrels and conflicts. You see, these Christians, they were in this state of disharmony, and they were giving evidence of worldliness. And James concluded that section by emphasizing humility. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. That was the root of the problem. If we don't work on humbling ourselves, we can grow in stubborn pride, which will reveal itself in all kinds of just different various ways. Now, in our text for today, we find that he gave two examples in which humility needs to be practiced by Christians. Humble people don't judge, and humble people don't make plans without considering God. So, number one, judging a brother, verses 11 and 12. Let's read this together. Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you who judge your neighbor? You know what I saw Larry doing the other day? Oh, yes, he did. And do you know why? Well, I'll tell you why. It's because he thinks this. You know, there's a saying, the only exercise some people get is jumping to conclusions and running people down. I mean, isn't judging and criticizing others so much easier than critiquing ourselves? And sometimes we're like the little boy showing his kindergarten picture, his kindergarten class picture to his neighbor. And he began pointing out and describing each classmate. This is Robert. He hits everyone. This is Stephen. He never listens to the teacher. This is Mark. He chases us and is very noisy and so forth. And finally, pointing to his picture, he said, and this is me. I'm just sitting here minding my own business. This word for speak against in the Greek, it's sometimes translated as slander. Now, in Romans 1:30, Paul used this word as one of the sinful things practiced by the heathen world. And Peter, he used this word in 1 Peter 2:1 when he told us to put aside all malice and all guile and hypocrisy and envy and all slander. What I believe is prohibited here is a Christian speaking out against a brother in Christ in the sense of judging and condemning him or her. You know, he who speaks against a brother or judges his brother. So we're often self-appointed judges. You know, we place ourselves on the bench and we proceed to observe the lives of our fellow Christians and pass judgment on them. Now, this is not talking about seeing a brother caught in a sin. That is a completely different situation. Galatians 6:1. We are to go to them and try to restore them in a spirit of gentleness. Or a brother who is teaching error. See, we're to take them aside, like with Priscilla and Aquila and Apollos in Acts chapter 18. This, I believe, is forming opinions about his or her motives, mannerisms, conduct, etc., and expressing those to the harm of the brother. We sometimes call it bad-mouthing or running each other down. See, it's behind the back, critical speech often intended to inflame others against the person being criticized. So, why should we not be doing this? Well, first, by implication, because we are brothers. I mean, notice how he kept saying one another and brother. I mean, this is a Christian family. And families, well, they don't do so well. They don't function properly when people are judging and bad-mouthing one another and fighting and bickering. I'm sure you've probably seen that in some physical families, maybe even your own. So you're supposed to defend and stand up for your family members. You're supposed to assume the best, not be assuming the worst and going around and accusing and condemning them. In the list of the seven things that God hates in Proverbs 6, it finishes with one who spreads strife among brothers. Well, second, because we judge the law. So James said that whenever we speak out against a brother, we're actually judging the law. And he may be referring to the royal law that he mentioned in chapter 2 and verse 8, which demands that we love our neighbor as ourselves. And so speaking against a brother, it certainly violates this law. And so by our actions, we're saying that, well, we're above it, you see, or that this law is not important, or that we don't think it's right. We're therefore judging the law to be wrong. That law on love is really not a very good one. And so I can just disregard it. And it's almost as if we think that we could do better. I mean, we could give a better law than God. And so James pointed out, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. And you may remember his emphasis in chapter 1 on being a doer of the word. As Christians, it is not our prerogative to critique what God requires of us. You see, our responsibility is to do whatever he commands, even if we don't like it, even if we don't understand why, even if we don't agree with it, even if it doesn't come easy, and even if it's not politically correct. We're not allowed to pick and choose. We're not above God's standards. We're under them, okay? And we're going to be judged by them. John 12, 48, Jesus said that we will be judged by his word. Now, thankfully, we also have the blood of Jesus. And third, because we take God's place. And James reminded us in verse 12 that there is only one lawgiver and judge, and it's not me. I'm not qualified for that job. See, this reality, it should humble us. It should cause us to shut our mouths from speaking out against one another. Only the one who is able to save and to destroy has the right to condemn. So by comparison, James asked, but who are you who judge your neighbor? Now in the Greek, you is placed forward. It's placed first for the sake of emphasis. You, yes, you. Just who do you think you are? See, I am a weak and frail human being with limited knowledge and limited understanding. And I certainly don't have the power and authority to save people from their wrongs or to destroy them because they did wrong. And so I actually place myself in the position of God when I condemn people by my own standards or by my ignorance. See, how often do we make judgments when we really have very little or no understanding of people's circumstances or their motives? Orbison, he gave this example. I thought it was pretty helpful. Someone might say, did you know Brother Jones does not put anything into the contribution plate? There may be a reason for this. Sister Jones may be doing it, and she may be sitting elsewhere for reasons unknown. If you draw a wrong conclusion because of lack of information and then spread it around, you may be guilty of bearing false witness. Okay, well, think about it like this. If you got kids, it's kind of like your four-year-old telling your two-year-old what they're doing wrong. They don't have enough understanding to do that. And so I'm not acting like a brother. I judge God's law to be unimportant by violating it, and then I act as if I were God. Really need to discipline our speech and be careful what we say concerning other people, especially if we're condemning them. And this is something that we all struggle with from time to time. And we really got to examine our motives, make sure that we're not putting someone down in the eyes of others trying to make ourselves feel better or look better or something like that in some way. Sadly, some people, they're so prideful that they would injure a brother just to soothe their own ego. And so humility is going to keep us from falling into it. All right? We live in just a very critical, fault-finding, backbiting society. Let's not bring that into the church. I like how Barnes put it. It may be presumed, unless there is evidence to the contrary, that others are as conscientious as we are. And it may commonly be supposed that they who differ from us have some reason for what they do, and may be desirous of glorifying their Lord and Master, and that they may possibly be right. You see, quit assuming that people have bad motives. People who love each other, they're going to look for and assume the best in one another. And we probably all come across those individuals who they've made a habit of going around pronouncing a judgment on the motives and the conduct and the beliefs of all their fellow Christians. Okay, they're self-appointed watchdogs. And if they don't like something that you're doing, or if you disagree with them in any way, all right, then you're obviously wrong and probably going to hell. And they're going to let everyone who will listen know about it. Got to make sure that that's not you and me. And again, this is not talking about a brother or sister who is clearly caught in a sin that they're practicing. But even in that situation, we're told to go to them, to personally go to them, not announce it to the world. Do not speak against one another, brethren. All right, number two, planning the future, verses 13 through 17. Let's continue reading. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. What are you looking forward to? What are you dreaming about? What is your vision of the future? What are your goals? What are your plans for your life? Sometimes, while preaching and teaching through this passage, people will use the illustration of the Titanic. See, 1912. The Titanic is a symbol of great human ambition. It was the largest ship of its day, all right, and they spared no expense in its construction. It was designed to be the pinnacle of comfort and luxury, and the list of what it contains, it goes on and on and on. But the Titanic, it is also a symbol of great arrogance. And among other things, the builders, they assured that it was unsinkable. Well, today it's at the bottom of the ocean, where it's been ever since its first and only voyage. I mean, it hit an iceberg, and less than 3 hours later, it's under the water. And over 1,500 of its passengers ended up dying. They didn't bring enough lifeboats on board for everyone. And ironically, they even canceled the emergency exercises scheduled for the day it sank. God himself could not sink this ship. Now, that quotation's a little hard to pin down, but it's reputed to have been the answer given by a deckhand when asked if the Titanic really was unsinkable. And so the Titanic is a symbol of great ambition, which is a good thing, and a symbol of great arrogance, which is a bad thing. So James, he began this next section by saying, come now. And it's an interjection here. All right? We find it repeated in chapter 5, verse 1. And you might say it's a call to pay attention, to consider your actions. Have you really thought through what you're saying, what you're doing? In verse 13, he specifies the problem here that he wants to address. These businessmen, okay, they're making the typical plans that businessmen make. Okay, they've done their market research. They're looking at their map, they're rearranging their storyboard or their flowchart, they're tweaking their PowerPoint presentation. Okay, maybe that's an anachronism. First century businessmen probably didn't have suits and ties like in my picture. I'm sure, though, they had PowerPoint. I don't know how you could survive without PowerPoint. But in their adventurous planning, you see, they had forgotten a key element. The problem is, as Christians, they made plans without considering God. They left him out of the equation. See, it's as if God didn't even exist to these guys. They're arrogantly saying that such and such will happen, when they really don't have as much control over their lives as they think. It's a humanistic approach to life. It's worldly thinking, which James had talked about in the previous section. It's arrogant to predict the future without taking God into consideration. Petrillo made the observation, God has so designed things on earth that there are few certainties with man. It is a bold statement of arrogance to make plans with such confidence. Jesus taught us to live our lives in continual readiness for his second coming, because man does not know when that day will come and interrupt all human plans. Jesus also taught the lesson about the rich fool, who thought he could control what his life would be like in the future. You know, Luke 12:16-21. We know how that turned out. His soul was required of him on the very night of his greatest financial triumph, you'd have to say. And so in verse 14, James tried to bring them to their senses with these two important facts. And the first is that life is uncertain. You do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. As it says in Proverbs 27:1, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. You know, those in his illustration, well, they're making plans that contained a year of tomorrows, but they really didn't even have a clue. They really didn't know what would occur in the first tomorrow. Now, our plan A is not always going to come to fruition. Man, I can prepare and plan and project, and I can have all my ducks in a row, and I can, you know, I can think this is it, but I can still be wrong. For example, a couple years ago when I was trying to get out of California, I was looking for a place to go. Well, I found a congregation in Colorado, and I thought it was perfect for my family. I was just sure it was a gift from God, and everything fell into place. I mean, everything just seemed to fall right into place. Well, a lot of people applied for that position, and it got down to me and this other guy, and I thought that I just hit it out of the ballpark, and yet he got it. I couldn't believe it. I was like, God, what's the deal? You know. But looking back, well, this is a better congregation, and this is a better place for my family to be. I also learned quite a bit from that experience. But I'll tell you, I was really scratching my head. Humans are certainly not omniscient, and we cannot possibly know what a day may bring forth. And so, again, this is putting self in the place of God. And second, life is brief. Just a vapor appears for a little while, vanishes away. Life is fragile. Life is short. We can't even assume that we're going to be living tomorrow. We don't know. None of us in this room, whether we'll even be around tomorrow. It's like the fog that might be seen in the early morning hours, but it's soon gone. You see, the sun rises in the sky. That's it. Who can build any solid hopes on a bit of mist? In chapter 1, he gave another illustration. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. So, the proper approach to life, the proper approach to the future is with this attitude, verse 15. If the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. Look, James is not condemning the practice of planning for the future. I certainly agree with the sayings. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. If you aim at nothing, well, you'll hit it every time. The book of Proverbs, it certainly talks about planning and getting advice. What James is pointing out here is the arrogance of people, and especially Christian people, who plan their lives without considering God and without recognizing that he is sovereign in this world. All of our plans, they should be qualified by this understanding, this mindset. As Woods pointed out, this does not mean that such words must always be on our lips and that we must give utterance thereto in formulating or expressing these plans. It is not a formula, but an attitude of heart which James enjoins and which must characterize us if we are to have the proper attitude toward God. I agree, but it might be helpful to actually say it out loud from time to time. You know, as Paul wrote to the Corinthians, but I will come to you soon if the Lord wills, chapter 4. And chapter 16,
I do not wish to see you now just in passing, for I hope to remain with you for some time if the Lord permits. And of course, we also find Jesus, you know, in his prayers saying, thy will be done. Now, obviously, don't overuse it, you know, to the point where it becomes obnoxious or simply a cliche. Lord willing, we'll make it through this worship service. Lord willing, I get a good parking spot at the restaurant. Please pass me that songbook. Lord willing, I will pass you this songbook. Lord willing, I won't hit you with my Bible. Cut that out. If the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. Here's something to think about. God may let us fail in a business venture to keep us humble or to try to help us overcome our love of money or something else. I mean, we need to consider that possibility. I mean, he may be trying to teach us something and saying this or that. Obviously, this applies to more than just business. Now, some people, they have indeed gone too far with this text, trying to support the hyper-Calvinistic idea that God has predetermined every step of a person's life, as if he's just up there playing a video game. I don't think that's what James is teaching. See, God is the one who has put in place the brevity and the uncertainty of life, and he's the one who is ultimately in control. That doesn't take away human free will. Choices are constantly being placed before us, and that's why there's a judgment day. The problem here is that there are so many people who get caught up in the everyday existence of this life and in this realm, you know, work, investments, school, children, family, recreation, and so forth, and they soon begin directing their lives as if there was no God. And James, he said that this is arrogance. And as we read in the previous section, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Chapter 4, verse 6. Verse 16, you boast in your arrogance, all such boasting is evil. See, it's boasting because you're claiming that you will achieve something on your own power, your own authority, your own knowledge. And it's evil, well, not just because of the arrogance and really placing yourself in his position, but because it excludes God from your life. And so I think he's making the same point. Just who do you think you are? See, the arrogant, godless goal setting of these businessmen, it serves as an example and an illustration of what all Christians should avoid. And so this would include anyone like you and me who might live his or her life without the recognition of God. We always need to live our lives with a view to his will for us. So what is his will? People always ask that question. Well, the big things are told to us in his word. For instance, 1 Thessalonians 4, for this is the will of God, your sanctification. That is, that you abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, and so forth. Read your New Testament. To ignore God's desire for us and his role in this world, it's a serious matter. And again, James said that it is sin. It's evil. And sin is what separates someone from God. Well, the final verse here in chapter 4, this concluding thought from James. Now, notice how he said, therefore. It's connecting it to what he just talked about, what he just said. Therefore, the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. This may have been a common Christian saying that James was applying to this situation. I mean, it's certainly a universal truth, sometimes called the sin of omission. We find passages like Matthew 25, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And you remember the parable of the Good Samaritan, Luke chapter 10. It's a classic example of this. You get the priest and the Levite, and well, they left, okay, they saw the man who was left for dead, and they wouldn't do him any harm. But neither would they help him. And now, interestingly, I looked it up, and some states actually have laws on the books requiring that people at least notify law enforcement or seek aid for someone in peril. I mean, you can actually get in trouble for doing nothing. Christianity is more than not doing certain things. See, there are sins of commission, deliberately doing sinful things, and there are sins of omission, refusing to do what you know is right. And maybe James is saying in this situation, well, if you didn't before, now you know. So they know the right thing to do, that is to make plans with God in mind. And so if they plan without God, they sin. And again, he's not saying not to schedule, budget, or plan. Making plans, that's a good thing. But when you plan, do it humbly. See, hold it in an open hand, not a closed hand. Write it in pencil, if you will. We need to be sure that we're always approaching the future with this mindset. If the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. And if not, we might get so, caught up in the pursuits of this world that we end up like that rich man, like the rich fool in Jesus' parable. God said to him, "You fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared?" He completely left God out of his thinking and his plans. See, there was only a thought for his will and not the Lord's will. But there are too many businessmen in this world that don't listen to the advice of James and, of course, Jesus. So back to the overarching theme. This is it. Humility. Just who do you think you are? Humility should guide how we approach one another, because humble people don't judge, in the sense talked about here. And humility should guide how we approach our plans. Humble people don't make plans without God. We need to quit putting ourselves in the place of God, me included. And these are two common areas where we like to help God out. Big quotation marks there. There is a God, and he is not me. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him, it is sin.